It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM, WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
There are also no guarantees in adversarial litigation. What is different here is that the binding collaborative law agreement requires a lawyer to withdraw if his or her client has been less than fully honest or showing bad faith.
Robin Edwards, managing attorney of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society in Charlottesville, discusses collaborative law, a brand new method of resolving family law disputes. And you'll find out how a simple adoption can be anything but simple during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 44, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. On April 1st, food stamp benefits increased 13.6% due to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. For example, maximum monthly benefits received by a four-person household rose $80 from $588 per month to $668 per month. Also on April 1st, the food stamp program became the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The increase was immediately applied to benefits, and participants don't need to do anything to get the increase. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, every $5 increase in new benefits generates a total of $9.20 in community spending. SNAP continues to be the largest domestic nutrition assistance program, providing a vital supplement to the food budgets of more than 280,000 Virginia households each month. Today, households get benefits with electronic benefit transfer cards, similar to debit cards, not stamps or coupons. Eligibility and application requirements for SNAP benefits remain the same. More information and applications are available at your local Department of Social Services. In other news, Virginia, along with nine other states, earned a failing grade from a national teen dating violence prevention organization. In its 2009 state-by-state teen dating violence report card, Break the Cycle says that Virginia, along with 15 other states, does not specify who can file for a protective order on behalf of a juvenile. The group offers education and intervention for teens and advocates for laws to protect and promote healthy teens. In Virginia, if you are 18 or older, you can file for a protective order yourself. But if you are under 18, the law does not say who can file for you. It will be up to the individual courts and judges whether a juvenile can get a protective order without a parent's permission. Because one in three teens will experience some form of abuse in a dating relationship, Break the Cycle believes that anyone 12 or older should be able to file for a protective order, and that states should remove requirements for parental involvement, permission, or notification. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Marching up the freedom land. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's legal term of the week is collaborative law. Collaborative law is a new way to resolve legal disputes. Each party has a separate and specially trained attorney. The lawyer's only job is to help the parties reach agreement. If the attorneys don't succeed in helping the client settle, the attorneys are out of a job. They never can represent either client against the other. Everyone agrees to work together with respect, honesty, and good faith. They try to find win-win solutions to the reasonable needs of both parties. Four creative minds work together to come up with an agreement without going to court. If anyone goes to court, collaborative law ends and the parties must get new lawyers. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and collaborative law is this week's legal term of the week.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time now for the weekly question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is Jill, and I'm from Chesterfield.
Welcome to the show, Jill. What question do we have this week?
My question is, what are the proceedings for grandparents adopting grandchildren?
And tell me a little bit more about the facts. How long have the grandchildren lived with your parents, and whose children are these anyway?
These children are my sisters, and they've lived with the grandparents for their entire birth.
Since birth, in other words. And how old are they? How old is the oldest, rather?
The oldest is 13, just had a birthday.
Okay, congratulations. And I guess final question, what about the biological father? Is he known? Is his whereabouts known? What's his relationship to the children?
The biological father, there may be two or three. We don't know specifically. One we do, and he's not in the picture at all. Never have been.
Okay. Jill, that's a very complicated situation, and I'll just give you generally what the law is for adoption in Virginia. The biological parents, if known, both have to consent, and that consent has to be done in writing. So just appearing in front of a juvenile and domestic relations court judge and saying so orally is not enough. It has to be done in writing. It sounds as if your sister is willing to do that, and that's half of the battle. But remember, it took two parents to bring the child into the world, and the father's rights also have to be terminated, assuming the father is even known. Now, if the biological father is simply unknown for one or more of the children, then your sister could sign an affidavit saying that, and the adoption could go through on her consent alone. But if the biological father is known for, you know, one or more of the children, then at least for those children for whom the biological father is known, he's got to be located and his consent obtained. If he can't be located, then you have to make at least a good faith effort to try to do that, and possibly the adoption could go through without his written consent. But it's much easier to do it with the biological parents' written consent. Now, the reason I asked how old they are, because if the child is 14 years of age or older, then that child must consent to the adoption. That's not an issue in this case because the oldest one is only 13. Now, adoptions have to be filed in the circuit court where the child lives, and typically people will need an attorney for filing an adoption in the circuit court. It's not a difficult process, but it is a complicated one. A lot of I's have to be dotted and T's have to be crossed. Basically, you file the petition for the adoption. You can also ask for a name change. You also file the consents. What then happens is the court orders the local Department of Social Services to study the home of the prospective adoptive parent. It doesn't matter that the children live there all their life. The Department of Social Services still has to do the home study. That should be fairly routine in this case, and if the results of the home study are favorable, the court then give a temporary order approving the adoption. There then will be more visits. There's supposed to be at least three such visits in the next 6 months, and then the court gives a final order approving the adoption. So it's a lot of paperwork. It's a few visits. The most important thing in your parents' case is going to be locating those absent fathers and getting their consent. Thank you very much for your question. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Charlottesville office of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society, and we're talking with Robin Edwards, the managing attorney. Welcome to the show, Robin.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
Good. We're going to be talking today about what is the newest alternative dispute resolution mechanism, collaborative family law. This is one of the hottest new things in the legal system. Tell us, what is collaborative family law?
Well, collaborative family law is a new and exciting way to resolve family law disputes. In a collaborative process, each party would have a separate and specially trained attorney. And in this situation, the lawyer's only job is to help the parties settle the case. If the attorneys do not succeed in helping the client settle, those attorneys are out of the job. And the way this works is that if either client threatens to go to court or the settlement is not successful, these same attorneys can never represent either client against each other in a court proceeding. And in collaborative law, everyone agrees to work together with respect, honesty, and good faith. They try to find win-win solutions to the reasonable needs of both parties. No one may go to court or threaten to go to court. And as I said before, if anyone does go to court, the collaboration ends.
Well, now, is collaborative law only for divorces?
No, Marty, it's not. Collaborative law can be used to negotiate agreements on custody, visitation of children, child support, and spousal support. The parties can negotiate agreements before marriage, after separation, and agreements even ending gay and lesbian partnerships. Collaborative law can also be used in non-family law disputes. It can be used essentially whenever parties want a creative and civilized process that uses attorneys outside of court and puts the risk of failures on the lawyers as well as the clients.
Well, now, Robin, this sounds a lot like mediation, but what is the difference between collaborative law and mediation?
Well, there's a big difference between collaborative law and mediation, and the primary difference is that a mediator is one party, a neutral party that's trying to help the parties settle the case. But in the course of the mediation, those parties could threaten litigation, while in the collaborative setting, that is not the case. And in addition, in collaborative law, each party has a legal advocate there on their side to help them. And collaborative law deals with problems while keeping settlement as the only goal. Mediation would not do that. So it does level the playing field much more so than mediation does.
Well, this sounds a little bit like the traditional adversarial process where each side has an advocate and they're doing battle against each other. How is collaborative law different from this traditional adversarial process?
The primary difference is both parties and both attorneys are actually working toward the goals of both parties, not just their own client. While the attorney still owes a fiduciary duty to their client, the goal of the process is an open and honest exchange of information. Neither party is taking advantage of miscalculations or mistakes, but instead they'll identify them and correct them. The children are kept out of the dispute. If there are financial issues in the course of the divorce, they will use joint accountants and appraisals. A respectful and creative effort to meet the reasonable needs of both parties replaces the bargaining backed by threats of lawsuit.
Well, now, in an adversarial litigation, the parties can do what we call discovery to get documents and information from the other side. Is there something like this in collaborative law?
Discovery is not necessary because both sides sign a binding collaborative law agreement at the beginning of the process to disclose all documents and information that relate to the issues early, fully and voluntarily. So hiding the ball and stonewalling are not permitted, and both lawyers must work to assure that the complete disclosure of the needed information is accomplished.
But Robin, what happens if one side does play hide the ball? If they're dishonest or they misuse the collaborative law to take advantage of the other side?
Well, Marty, that can happen, clearly due to human nature. There's no guarantee that a party will be completely protected if someone in collaborative law acts in bad faith. There are also no guarantees in adversarial litigation. What is different here is that the binding collaborative law agreement requires a lawyer to withdraw if his or her client has been less than fully honest or showing bad faith.
Well, is collaborative law the best choice for every client in a family law dispute?
Well, it isn't for every client, but it's certainly worth considering if some or all of the following are true for the client. For example, the client wants a civil and respectful settlement of the issues. They want to keep open the possibility of friendship with their partner and their partner's family. It certainly will make co-parenting their children better. If clients want privacy and do not want the details of their problems in a public court record, this is an excellent process for resolving their family law issues. If the clients want to have control over the resolution of their case and not hand over the decision to a stranger who would be the judge, I think these are things that you have to evaluate. It's not for every situation, but I think that it's a new idea that people should consider in family law.
Would you say that collaborative family law would ever be appropriate in, say, a domestic violence situation?
That's hard to say. I would. My first reaction to that would be no, because there's such an uneven dynamic there between the abuser and the abused. But depending on the degree of the domestic violence, I think sometimes this might actually be a better way of resolving the case, because I think the court system, the adversarial system, is actually set up in a way where the abused person feels even more vulnerable. So depending on the degree of the violence, this may actually be a good way to resolve that, as long as the attorney for the quote-unquote abuser can control his or her client.
Now, how is collaborative law different from settling a case in a usual law practice? Because most family law cases do settle. So this sounds a lot like the settlement process.
I think it goes to the emotions that the clients will feel after the settlement. Many family law cases are literally settled on the courthouse steps, and by that time a lot of money has been spent and a lot of emotional damages happen. I think both buyers and sellers' remorse are common. Settlements reached in the shadow of trial and are generally shaped by what the lawyers believe the judge is likely to do, and that is not how a collaborative law settlement would be reached.
So why is this so effective then?
Well, it really goes to this state of mind. The collaborative lawyers have a completely different state of mind about their jobs than traditional lawyers. They're really working for the greater good of the couple rather than just the greater good of their client. So essentially, instead of being dedicated to getting the most for their client, no matter what cost, collaborative lawyers are dedicated to helping their clients achieve their highest goals and for themselves. So these lawyers are not acting as hired guns. They're not taking advantage of mistakes made by the other side. They're not threatening or focusing on the negative. And collaborative lawyers, I think there's a lot more trust between collaborative lawyers than in the traditional adversarial system. So it's this state of mind of the attorneys, which therefore filters down to the clients, which makes collaborative law so effective.
Well, now, does a family lawyer have to undergo any type of special training in order to do collaborative family law?
Yeah, they must take a basic training in collaborative process and practice. There are trainings being held around the state. And there's actually a further 3-day training if you want to do collaborative law involving a team, where you actually have psychologists who act as coaches for the clients and financial analysts and sometimes a child specialist. Sometimes it will be different professionals who actually work with the collaborative lawyers as a team. So there's even a further training. So it's very important that lawyers take these trainings, because it really is important that they understand the state of mind and go into the process with the proper training.
Well, now, Robin, I understand that last month in March, mm-hmm. you went to a family law collaborative family law training in Charlottesville. Could you tell our listeners briefly about that?
Yes, it was part of a pro bono project, actually, that Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and University of Virginia Law School are putting together to train lawyers in the area about collaborative process and practice. And it was given by Delina Stickley and Frank Morrison, two attorneys who are experts in collaborative law. And there was a lot of, I guess, fishbowl role playing, and it really opened my mind up to what they called a paradigm shift in the lawyer's state of mind. We had to do a lot of role playing, and sometimes you would forget who your client was because you were really working towards the goals of both clients.
Well, I remember one training that you and I went to that was, in fact, done by Frank Morrison. It wasn't on collaborative law directly, but it was about negotiation, and it was that famous hypothetical where one party is given a scenario where they need the turtle egg shells, and the other one needs the turtle egg yolks. Right. And you and I were negotiating, and we came to an impasse. You remember that?
Yes, I do remember that. That was a few years ago. I do remember that.
And why did we come to an impasse there?
Because we couldn't see outside of the box, and we were really just looking at our own clients' needs. And I think it was a negotiation class, and I think I was coming at it, well, what's going to be best for my client, and I'm not going to let the other side know what my bottom line is. And I think we just held back too much and we weren't trying to solve the problem.
And yet there were other people in that same scenario who revealed information and they came to the settlement because they realized that it was a win-win.
Exactly. And in collaborative law, you're freed from those bonds of trying to hold back and get the best possible financial deal for your client. You're working for the greater good. And ultimately, that's probably is better for your client in the long run.
Well, now, what if the other party chooses a lawyer who doesn't know anything at all about collaborative law?
Well, that does happen, and I guess what you need to do, I mean, if the person already has the other party already has an attorney, you as an attorney can send to that lawyer information to share with his or her client about the collaborative process, and I believe that attorney is ethically bound to share that with his or her client. And you certainly can talk to your client and encourage your client to share the informational brochures and collaborative commitment agreement with his or her spouse or partner.
Well, now, why is it so important to sign one of these binding collaborative law agreements? Why can't you just work collaboratively with the other lawyer, but then go to court if it doesn't work out?
Well, I think because that's the essential piece of collaborative law. Without the collaborative commitment agreement where you are committing to settling the case or else you have to get a new lawyer and you can't go to court, I mean, I think that really gives people the motivation they need to be honest and to work with this process.
Well, now, I understand that Central Virginia Legal Aid Society in Charlottesville has started a pilot project for collaborative family law. Can you tell our listeners briefly about that?
Yes, I can. We did have the training a couple weeks ago, and we have now, I would say, between the attorneys that are trained and the ones that were already trained in Charlottesville, probably about 20 or 30 collaboratively trained attorneys in the Charlottesville area, and there are actually a couple in the Richmond area as well. And I would say about 3/4 of those attorneys are going to take pro bono cases for us. And the way it will work is when we get clients that have family law issues that are interested in the collaborative process, we will give that client information and this list of attorneys to share with their spouse or partners. And like I said before, if they already have an attorney on the other side, we'll send that information to the attorney. The idea is if the spouse or partner is also interested in the collaborative process, he or she will contact one of those attorneys on the list. That person can get a pro bono attorney if they're within 300% of the poverty guidelines. And once that person has enlisted an attorney from that list, that attorney will call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society, and then we will refer our client to the Collaborative Family Law Clinic at the University of Virginia, who will represent our client.
That all sounds tremendously exciting, Robin. We
Yes.
have been speaking with Robin Edwards, the managing attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society in Charlottesville, about collaborative family law. Thank you so much for being on the show, Robin.
Thank you, Marty.
This week's top 3 tips are about spousal support or alimony. The first tip is that spousal support is money paid from a husband to a wife or from a wife to a husband when they are separated or divorced. The second tip is that unlike child support, spousal support is not automatically owed. It depends on many factors, such as how long the marriage has lasted and the contributions, both monetary and non-monetary, of each party to the marriage. The third tip is that Virginia is not a palimony state. Unmarried people who live with each other, even for many years, don't owe each other any duty of support when they separate. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and for this week, that's our top three tips.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. Also, if you have a question you would like answered or any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. Please include your name and phone number. You also can leave that same information before 8 a.m. or after 6 p.m. by calling 200-6045. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Under the stimulus bill, laid-off workers now are eligible for a 65% federal subsidy for up to 9 months to keep their employer-provided health insurance. Join us next week when Jill Hankin from the Virginia Poverty Law Center explains this new help for workers who have lost their jobs. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegwerth.